Psychiatric service dogs are amazing. They retrieve, open and close doors, turn lights on and off, and now are trained to mitigate post-traumatic stress disorder. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thousands of troops have returned to the U.S. suffering from PTSD. A Des Moines-based not-for-profit called Pause and Effect is helping some Iowa veterans with it live better lives. This hour, a conversation with combat veteran Wade Baker and the executive director of Pause and Effect, Nicole Shumate. Baker has just been matched with a psychiatric service and mobility dog trained by Pause and Effect. Psychiatric service dogs, after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Thousands of veterans have returned from combat in Iraq and Afghanistan suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. In addition, many veterans also have to learn to live with physical injuries. A Des Moines-based not-for-profit called Pause and Effect is helping some Iowa veterans live better lives. This hour, a conversation I had recently with combat veteran Wade Baker and the executive director of Pause and Effect, Nicole Shumate. Baker has just been matched with a psychiatric service and mobility dog trained by Pause and Effect. So, Wade Baker and Nicole Shumate, I want to welcome you to River to River. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
And below the table where we're talking is really the guest of honor. His name is Honor, and he is one of the psychiatric service and mobility animals trained by Pause and Effect, but we'll get to his role in just a moment. Wade Baker, if I can start out with you, 41-year-old resident of Nevada, Iowa. What can you tell us to start off with about your military service, where and when you served? Can you tell us a little bit?
I was attached to the 1st Infantry Division of the Big Red 1 out of Fort Riley, Kansas, who was deployed to Iraq for the Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. After that, when I was PCS to Germany, I did 6 months in Macedonia and then back-to-back 6 months in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm. You were have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. When was that diagnosis made?
Approximately 4 years ago was the official diagnosis. We knew there was something going on before that, but I tried to deal with it myself and was unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm. Well, may I ask what sort of symptoms led you to believe that there was something that eventually led to this diagnosis?
It initially started when I first came home from Iraq. My parents and my wife at the time all stated that I was different. And my excuse was, of course, I'm different. I've seen the elephant, and things are going to be a little different. And they just got progressively worse. I was afraid to seek treatment because I was going to be a career man. And if I'd have said anything at the time, I was afraid they'd bounce me out of the military for being a nut job. Didn't really get bad until after I got out of the service. And then I had no support, no means of release, no way to really help control it. And then I turned to alcohol. I turned to drugs. I even turned to pornography, just any vice I could find that would keep the endorphins flowing in my brain to shut me down when I wanted to shut down, to turn on when I wanted to turn on.
Mm-hmm. Well, why did these symptoms then pop up? Well, most of us, thankfully, do not experience the type of stress that you do in combat. Explain why the symptoms would become problematic once you're out of the theater of combat.
I wish I could give you a real good answer on that, a doctor's type answer. Well, we did 4 days of combat in the Gulf War, the 100-hour war, they called it. And for 4 days, we were in a constant movement to contact and fighting battles for the full 4 days. There was no rack time for most of us. There was no downtime. It was constant go, go, go. And then when you come home, it first starts off that things that bother people at home, who wore what to church, the weather, little things people complain about at home mean nothing. And the things that truly do matter are harder to keep up with, harder to control. And then I found once I got out of the military, it was tenfold worse.
Mm-hmm. So those things when people are talking about what you then after your service would see as inconsequential in life, your reaction to that was what? Anger?
Anger, frustration. I'm trying to think of a good word for it. People kind of lose their value.
Mm-hmm. And so your reaction, the most problematic symptoms for you of PTSD would be outbursts at when these things would happen? Or
my problems got full-blown and full force. We had a house fire in the middle of the night. We all managed to get out, but we lost our house. And that's when the trigger was really tripped for me. Angry outbursts, avoidance of people, of places.
Crowds, that's a common
crowds,
symptom.
Crowds, just people in general. I turned into basically a house hermit. I went out when I had to work and I did what I had to do, but I masked the symptoms and the problems I was having with alcohol and with, well, at that time it was just alcohol. And then approximately 4 years ago, I attempted to commit suicide. And that's when I was taken to a small hospital in Ellsworth, Iowa. A young doctor came in, and I was telling him what he wanted to hear to get out, and he told me to shut up, and he told me what I was really having problems with. And we had a very good meeting there the first day, and he told me the only way I was getting out is if I came down to Iowa City to the VA, and he's been my doctor ever since.
Wow. What a turning point. What a great doctor.
He's a wonderful doctor. He's the only one there I trust.
Mention his name if you'd like.
Dr. Thad Abrams.
If you feel comfortable, could you share with us, help us understand that mindset when you were suicidal, how you could return to this country in relative peace and security and then want to kill yourself?
Well, I guess the easiest way for me to explain it is you're playing a game of chess and you realize you're two moves away from checkmate, and so you resign. There's nowhere else to go. There's nowhere else you can turn to.
Two moves away from checkmate. How so?
I was going to lose my family. I was going to lose my job. I didn't have any – the family that I did have, my parents and my sister at the time, unfortunately, didn't understand. They were worn out and tired of trying to care, really. I'd alienated everybody. And the easiest way out and the fastest way out was suicide.
You thought that was better for you and for your family?
Absolutely. At the time, I think it was the best option that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since receiving treatment and since receiving honor and with my family also learning, it's been a night and day difference. You know, we understand now what's going on, why it's going on. It doesn't make it go away, but it helps us to understand, okay, this is happening now. This is going to be the next step that's going to happen. So we can kind of prepare and work ourselves up to it.
Let's talk a little bit about honor. Honor is on a leash under the table right with you, Wade Baker. If you just joined us, Wade Baker, my guest, combat veteran, and resident of Nevada, Iowa, also diagnosed with PTSD, sharing that experience with us. And you've got a psychiatric service dog named Honor. You've had him for the last 3 weeks. So this is something new to you, having Honor. Would you introduce us to Honor?
Well, like you said, laying at my feet right where he's supposed to be is my psychiatric service dog, Honor. I received him from Pause and Effect, a nonprofit group that supplies these dogs to returning veterans and veterans suffering from PTSD and mobility, having mobility issues.
Mm-hmm. Honor is a beautiful young black lab, and I want to bring you into this, Nicole Shoemate. You are the executive director of Pause and Effect. So tell us a little bit more about the mission of Pause and Effect, how it started.
Sure. Pause and Effect was formed in 2006 when I first moved to Iowa. The original intention was to create a nonprofit that would support therapy dogs in the state of Iowa. There wasn't really one unifying organization when we first moved to the community. It was something that my husband and I enjoyed participating in when we lived in Colorado. So initially, the nonprofit was supposed to be a very small, very manageable endeavor while I went to law school. And then the third year of law school, I learned that there was going to be an entire brigade deploying through the Iowa National Guard. And because I had had contact with the Army in Colorado, I had done some search and rescue work and worked with a lot of soldiers while I was there. it kind of came to me that maybe the best way to support that effort and I guess really kind of support a new community that I had grown to like was to bring in a litter of dogs and train them as service dogs. And so my third year of law school, after promising my husband that I was going to grow up and become an attorney and to get licensed, I changed directions and continued my dog training career. And we brought in the first litter of service dogs. So that probably occurred in 2010.
Okay. So the first litter of service dogs is how large?
It was the litter we displaced. We placed 10 dogs total.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we have Honor with us, the black lab. Wade just introduced us to his new companion, Honor. What else can you tell us about Honor and these other dogs? What sets them apart from our pets?
Sure. You know, I think the biggest feature is that these dogs spend a lot of time out in public with their puppy raisers. They are exposed to any number of public environments. We take them to New York City to make sure that they have traveled on public transportation. So they board two flights going to New York City, two flights coming back from New York City. They ride the subways. They ride the Staten Island Ferry. They see a Broadway show. These dogs are really, really well-traveled. They spend an evening on Broadway at night when it's already dark, after a really long day, after traveling to a new community. The dogs tend to be really stable at that point. Their exposure is just immense to any number of different opportunities. In addition to that, we teach the dogs some very specific tasks that we are finding just, I guess, from anecdotal evidence and from feedback from some of the recipients that seem to be helping a lot. So one of those tasks is that the dogs will stand perpendicular in front of somebody so that maybe if other people are, you know, having a conversation with them, it causes there to be a little bit more distance between two people having a conversation. Or the dogs will watch behind someone, and if somebody is approaching, the dog will wag their tail so that the recipient can see that somebody might be coming up behind them. So they don't always feel obligated to check behind them or be worried about what's happening behind them. They kind of have another set of eyes. The dogs also learn to turn lights on and off, open and close doors. So maybe if somebody would prefer to be in a closed room, the dogs will go and shut doors for them or turn a light on for them. We had a couple dogs that we just placed that very intuitively, the first night, at least for one combat veteran, woke him up three times out of a nightmare before the nightmare proceeded too far. So the dogs are doing a lot of, I think, really beneficial things. I think they help with some of the anxiety in public. And I think they're also – what I repeatedly heard over the two-week placement course was how much more sleep the guys were getting. And I think for me, seeing them become more rested and better able to handle stress because they were more rested, I think that was a really nice benefit as well.
This is amazing. So this is a skill set developed at these dogs specifically for combat veterans suffering from PTSD.
Correct.
Okay. And let me turn to you, Wade. We've heard an amazing – I would like to talk to Nicole for a couple hours about how these dogs actually do this. But I want to talk to you. You've had Honor for 3 weeks now. Which of these skills do you find early on yet to be helping you most?
Honor has awoken me from a nightmare. Honor also, if I'm agitated, not feeling myself, just a little bit tense, I find he rubs on me kind of like a cat. And if that doesn't calm me down, he'll get basically up in my lap, get his front feet and everything up in my lap, and draw my attention to him so that I'm off of either the flashback that I'm having or the beginning that I'm having. There's even times where he'll do it, and I'm like, I'm fine. I don't even realize that it's starting, but he can feel it coming.
How much of your interior life does Honor already know about?
I think Honor probably knows more about me than I know about myself already, to be honest with you.
In 3 weeks.
Well, it was the second week of training. We went to Jordan Creek Mall, and we were doing some training there. And we were on the second floor, and I was getting agitated and ready to leave. And I knew I was getting agitated.
What was bothering you?
The crowds were starting to build up. It was getting later in the morning time, and there was getting to be more people there. And I'd had my fill and wanted to leave. I needed to leave. And Honor came up, and he started rubbing on me. So I bent down, started petting him. Then he launched himself up into my lap and pushed me against the wall, and I was petting him, and then he looked at me, and then he looked away, and then he kind of looked about half back at me, and he yawned. Well, just 2 days before, we'd had a class, and that's one of the dog's signals to tell everybody, just calm down, just relax. And it clicked in my head, and I started laughing. I'm like, okay, who's training who? You know, he knows he knows what he's doing, and I'm not even sure what he was doing up until that point in time.
Nicole Shumate is with us. If you just joined us, she is executive director of Pause and Effect, a Des Moines-based not-for-profit organization. The organization trains and places psychiatric service and mobility dogs. And also joining us, Wade Baker, a combat veteran, a 41-year-old resident of Nevada, Iowa, the proud recipient of Honor, who is a new dog trained by Pause and Effect. Honor is below the table, the silent guest in this conversation. So in reading about Pause and Effect, Nicole, I read that these dogs can bring almost immediate relief in the form of being able to sleep. Was that true for you, Wade?
Absolutely. I told Nicole and I told a couple other people I slept more in that 2 weeks than I had in any month previous. Since leaving there, the sleep has been disrupted a little bit, but we've got a kind of a larger family and a madhouse. I still get more sleep than I had ever previously to receiving Honor.
Why? Is Honor like a buddy in your unit watching you?
That's kind of how Nicole put it off to us to begin with, and how I think everybody accepts it. He is. He's like your new battle buddy. He's never more than a couple feet from me unless he's running around the yard playing and I'm watching him. He sleeps with me. He's at my feet when I eat. Everything I do, everywhere I go, he's with me.
Mm-hmm. What other sort of – we talked about the emotional comfort, the chill-out example that you gave just a minute or two ago. But what tasks does he do? Maybe he's still learning these around your house or in your day-to-day comings and goings.
He's still learning tasks. I'm still learning tasks and working with him together. We were fortunate enough to be able to talk to our puppy raisers at a graduation, and that was a wonderful thing. Learned some of the things he does that I didn't know he did. The thing Honor and I have been working on the most lately is picking up dropped objects. He'll pick up just about anything for me, but keys seem to be the last thing they want to pick up because of the metal taste, I assume. And I'd be glad to show you, but he'd probably make a liar out of me today.
He would be. So in one instance, does having Honor pick up something come in handy? What's an example?
Well, he's not necessarily a mobility dog for myself, but I have degenerative joint disorder in my hips, mm-hmm. and I have arthritis in my knees. So dropping something for me, it takes on a whole new level of trying to get down to pick it up. So that was one of the skills that I wanted him to be able to maintain just for me.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, puppy raisers, they have been mentioned several times here. Let's talk about the training of one of these very special dogs and the role that Pause and Effect has and the role that the puppy raisers play.
Sure.
How are these dogs, first of all, if we start with the process, how are they selected? Is it only certain breeds, I assume?
We use Labrador Retrievers mostly in part because I think the public expects service dogs to be Labrador Retrievers. I think if we used other breeds of dogs, I think there would be more people likely to question whether they were service dogs. There'd be more interaction. And I think sometimes the recipients would just prefer to be able to go about their day and have fewer questions instead of more.
Mm.
So we buy the dogs by the litter. I have a couple breeders that I use. They're all in Iowa. One is out of Indianola. Another is out of Monroe. And so we buy dogs by the litter. We end up with many different personalities within any litter, which has been really nice. It allows me to really be selective in trying to match a specific dog to any particular recipient. So on the personality end, I can guarantee you they are not cookie cutter mm-hmm. Personalities.
Do they have to meet certain, also within this breed, a black lab, a certain intelligence test or an empathy test? Is there such thing in a dog that you can measure?
I guess that's not really how we test them, or maybe I haven't really thought about it in those contexts. They have to be pretty tolerant of new and novel circumstances. So you definitely want a dog that can go into a new circumstance and not be bothered by it. So we're looking for maybe an emotional stability that exists. And sometimes that takes a little while for them to develop. That's, that is definitely one of the challenges that our volunteer puppy raisers have is, You know, some of the dogs, they aren't, you know, as quick to adapt. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of effort goes into keeping those dogs out in public into new circumstances. We do work really heavily with the dogs. We clicker train them. And so we work really heavily with them on the training end. But to be honest, I think
clicker training.
Clicker training is a style of training used in a lot of commercial settings. You see it at large public aquariums where they might be teaching a killer whale to jump out of the water and touch a red ball with its nose. When that animal has performed that task, what the animal will hear is a short tweet out of a trainer's whistle. And then when they land back in the water, they'll get rewarded with a piece of fish. We use the same method with the dogs. But instead of the dogs hearing a tweet, they'll hear a click out of a clicker. Mm. So when they've done the task correctly, we'll still reward them with food or reward them with a tennis ball. Some of the dogs have preference for one or the other. But we spend a lot of time training them on their tasks. I have found, though, that the tasks are really only about 25% of the challenge. The bigger challenge really is keeping the dogs out in public so that they're just prepared for anything, prepared for people who might be wearing sunglasses or a hat or have different colored skin, prepared to be in a new community and still be able to perform. So I think the task training is a much smaller part than maybe the public understands. And so, you know, a huge shout out to our puppy raisers, because I think they do about 90% of the work for us.
And it sounds like they have to have extensive training too.
They spend the first 8 weeks they have a brand new puppy. They meet with me maybe once a week for an hour or two. So they learn about clicker training. They get the dogs through their basic obedience. And then as the dogs get older, we've had some really motivated puppy raisers who wanted to learn how to finish dogs. So people who had never, you know, professionally trained a dog before, had definitely never taken a dog to a service dog level, were teaching dogs how to turn lights on and off and teaching dogs how to pick items up and retrieve them competently. And, you know, we had all sorts of games that the dogs needed to learn how to play. So we had some pretty inspired puppy raisers this round.
By the time a dog like Honor is handed off to a recipient like Wade, how much does it cost to train a typical dog?
Wow, a lot. You know, Paws and Effect covers all of their veterinary care, covers the cost of all of their food, their crates, their leashes, toys. The list is fairly endless. And I calculate the cost of any particular dog kind of over the cost of a litter of dogs. Because I think in any litter, you're going to have a dog or two that, you know, chews a squeaker and ends up needing emergency surgery. Mm-hmm. Or just gets injured playing and maybe requires a little bit of extra rehabilitation or extra care. So when you calculate the costs over a litter, and then also the costs we incur for the dogs that don't graduate, you know, dogs that we had to pay to acquire and also take care of until such a time that we decide they're not going to make the cut and make it to graduation, and trainers' salaries. When you put all of that together, it comes out to about $15,000 or $20,000 per dog. And the recipients receive them at no cost. So all of those costs are absorbed by Paws and Effect.
Nicole Shoemate, Executive Director of Paws and Effect, talking about training psychiatric service and mobility dogs. Coming up, we'll hear how combat veteran Wade Baker came into contact with Paws and Effect and about the first day he met with his new dog, Honor. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour, a conversation I had recently with combat veteran Wade Baker of Nevada, Iowa, and the executive director of Paws and Effect, Nicole Shoemate. Baker, a veteran of the Gulf War who was diagnosed with PTSD, has just been matched with a psychiatric service and mobility dog trained by Paws and Effect. And, as you may have heard in the first half of our program, having this new service dog, named Honor, has made a tremendous difference in Wade's life. Let's get back to that conversation. Wade, I understand you were a dog owner before you had Honor.
Yes, I was. I had an old English bulldog that did some of the things that Honor can do without being actually trained. He was just very in tune and very focused to me. And when I moved the very first day, he was struck by a car and killed. And my sister said, well, if you get another dog, she said, I'll help you train it. And that sounded like a great deal to me. So we talked about it and talked about it and talked about it. And then Nicole was in Marshalltown putting on a show talking to a group there in the Marshalltown Kennel Club. And my sister asked me to go. So I went with her to the presentation. And when the presentation was over, I walked outside and I'd had enough of being indoors and the people that were there, the crowd. And then Nicole, my wife, and my sister came outside. My wife and sister were crying. Shortly later, Nicole was crying. And my sister told me, she said, there's no way I can train a dog to do what these dogs do. And I said, yeah, I know. It was no surprise. I'd met Tag that night and seen the things he could do. Mm. And we weren't competent to train a dog the way that these dogs are trained to do what they do.
You said crying. What was behind that emotional response?
My sister was afraid she let me down. She was afraid that with all the talk of what she could do for me and do with the dog, you know, she thought she could do, she was afraid that I'd be upset because she couldn't do it. And like I said, after being in the presentation for 10 minutes, I knew there was no way, you know, myself and her were going to be able to train this dog.
Mm-hmm. So you recognized then also that a dog like Honor would be an immense help to you.
We were fairly certain that a dog like Honor would be a great addition to my life and getting my life back. And it was shortly after that that Nicole invited me down to Camp Dodge to actually sign the papers to put in a request to be with the first class.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell me about that first day, about meeting Honor for the first time. You would be nervous, right? Or not?
There was a lot of anxiety, a lot of excitement going into it. And somebody with PTSD doesn't handle excitement, anxiety very well. The first 2 days of class, I wasn't real friendly with anybody. Not that I didn't want to be. It was just.
Are you with the dogs at this point?
No.
So you have to receive your training before.
Correct. I'm
Honor scratching
and shaking. No. We didn't have the dogs the first 2 days, and I was fit to be tied. I was not happy with the whole situation whatsoever. Just it was a new experience. It was a lot of anticipation. I knew who Honor was, but I hadn't got to actually, you know, hang out with him yet. And like I said, when you have PTSD, you don't handle those things well. So there was a lot of emotion going into it, meeting Honor for the first time.
So Nicole, you're there at this time too, getting the recipients ready for their new dogs. You're seeing Wade among the others. Wade says, by his own account, he was not in good shape. You are evaluating the potential recipients at the same time that you were evaluating and matching the dogs?
We were. Even coming into it, I think I knew some of the guys better than some of the others. And, you know, I think by many of their own admissions, some of the guys are not particularly talkative. They kind of keep their distance. And so there were a couple dogs, I think, in my mind that I had matched. And there were a few that I wasn't sure who was going to take them home yet.
Okay, so back up a little bit. You're talking about matching the dog with the person, the recipient. What goes into that? What is a good match?
You know, so for me, at least with Wade and Honor, some of it was very practical. Honor was a dog that had a little bit more drive and is a little bit more active, although you wouldn't know it today. And his trainer or his puppy raiser actually lives in Cedar Rapids, and the Toms family had been taking Honor to dog agility classes. So Honor kind of showed up with an extra special skill set, which is already knowing a lot about dog agility when he got turned back in. So when we were evaluating things long before the course, like maybe 3 or 4 weeks before the course, I wanted to be able to take advantage of some of the dogs' unique abilities. I think each of the dogs kind of came back with different assets. And, you know, in that case, one of the things that's really nice about our partnership with Canine Craze is that recipients can continue to attend dog training classes at Canine Craze for free.
And tell me what Canine Craze is.
Canine Craze is a dog training facility in Urbandale that has been absolutely fantastic. They've partnered with us for more than 6 years. And they have a fantastic and amazing dog agility program. So when Honor came back in and already had a dog agility training skill set, we really wanted to take advantage of that. And one of the ways we could do that was placing Honor with a combat veteran who lived close enough that could continue to train him at Canine Craze. So that was one thing that worked in favor of placing Honor with Wade. The other thing is that Honor can be a little bit naughty, and it was going to force Wade to go out in public. It was going to force Wade to have to work with him. We had some other dogs that were pretty laid back, and I was a little bit concerned that if we matched Wade with a dog that was too relaxed, that Wade wouldn't necessarily get out of the home more.
Did you recognize that, Wade, that Honor's in your life to challenge you?
Yeah, she explained that to me, and I appreciate it. If she'd have given me a lazy dog, we'd both be sitting on the couch right now.
In what way does Honor challenge you? You're sitting at home, and if not for Honor, you'd stay there. But what does Honor do?
When we're there and we're not doing a whole lot, he gets bored, and he'll come up and he'll nudge me. He'll let me know he wants to go outside. He'll bring me sticks. If he knows we're going somewhere, and he's almost psychic in that ability. He just gets, I don't want to say wound up. He gets excited. There's a lot of tail wagging. There's a lot of hopping around. He wants to work. He has a drive. He wants to work.
I'm talking with combat veteran Wade Baker of Nevada, Iowa, who suffers from PTSD, and Nicole Shoemate of Pause and Effect. That's a not-for-profit organization which trains and places psychiatric service and mobility dogs. Now, Wade, I understand, and we hear reports that dogs are used in the field of combat. In your time in combat, were there dogs, service dogs in the military?
The only service dogs I know of then were security dogs for around the Air Force bases and things like that. I never actually got to see a working dog in the field. You have to remember that was 100 years ago, back in 1991 through 98. So
seems like
a long way since then.
It seems like 100 years to you.
Seems like a long time, yes.
But yet those memories are still with you, the ones you're trying to quell, to quiet a bit.
Correct.
I read too that the dogs will. You mentioned flashbacks, Wade. Honor is aware. He's monitoring you when you're sleeping, looking out for flashbacks.
I'm not sure how they trained him or how he knows to do this. Even when, like now, he's laying here on the floor and you'd think he was asleep. If I move, he'll jump.
Mm-hmm. Can you relay an instance when you were suddenly back in Iraq and he came to your rescue, so to speak?
It would be the nightmare I had. Like I said, I generally don't sleep that well, but I've been sleeping better lately with Honor. And I was having a flashback nightmare, and I woke up with Honor standing on my chest, licking my face. And, of course, that's kind of a startled response when you try to figure out what that is, standing on top of you, licking your face. And I opened my eyes, and he's standing there just licking my face, going away at it. And I tried to push him away, and he comes back, and he's just incessant on just kind of being obnoxious if I didn't know any better. And so then I start petting him, and then It's calming me down, and I'm realizing, okay, I know what he did. I understand what happened now. At first, all I knew was the dog was standing on me, licking my face, and I couldn't figure out what his problem was.
So what was he doing?
He was waking me up, and he was stopping the nightmare for me. He was, for however he figured it out, I was asleep. I don't know if I know my wife said sleeping with me is like sleeping with an epileptic. I jerk, twitch, and squirm all night long.
And this is after you returned from combat?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Before that, it was not so. You could sleep better before you went to Iraq.
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. 8 hours a night was no problem for me.
So, Nicole, is this common among the veterans, the combat veterans who receive these dogs, the experience that Wade just relayed?
It has been with this last litter of dogs. We opened up a Facebook group. So it's closed to the public, but open to raisers and recipients and the dog trainers. And I think it's been a very common theme. The dogs interrupting nightmares, the dogs interrupting flashbacks, being really persistent and not letting their minds wander to places that really maybe aren't appropriate at that time of the day. You know, it's not – there's no value in having a flashback at lunch. And so it's been neat to hear feedback from the guys that it's going really well for them.
How much do the dogs understand what's going on? Or is this just a sort of an auto response that a dog would give to another dog or to a human to calm down? How much do they understand us, do you think, Nicole?
You know, it's really hard to know. I think a lot of it does go back to the method of training that we use, getting rewarded for good behaviors, guessing. The dogs spend a lot of time early on guessing what the next correct behavior might be.
For instance?
If you're trying to teach a dog something silly, like maybe just spin in a circle, you know, we teach the dogs to be fairly creative. And so it's a game of hotter and colder. Maybe they move a shoulder and we reward them for moving a shoulder. And maybe they move that shoulder a little bit more and it's a little bit closer to a circle and we reward them again. And they learn very quickly that guessing and creativity is something that dog trainers like. And I think what happens is when they're placed in a new environment and maybe something distressing is happening and they're trying to figure out how to make that stress stop, they're guessing at ways. They're trying to find a way that's going to make the difficult circumstance stop. And maybe that circumstance – or maybe that attempt is seen in licking somebody's face. We had one gentleman who had been having difficulty with nightmares and his dog finally just barked at him and had probably made several other attempts to wake him up that weren't successful and the dog just guessed at the next thing. So you're creating really inquisitive, creative minds, but also they're pretty persistent. I mean, the dogs, they're pretty sure when they think they've got it right and they'll let you know. I mean, they'll bark back at you and ask for a treat or they'll nudge you pretty hard and remind you that they've done the right thing. So you've really created a relationship with the dog. And I think traditional dog training used to be a lot more domineering. You could force a dog into a position and keep them in a position. And clicker training really does demand that a relationship exist, that they contribute to the relationship and get rewarded for contributing to the relationship. And I think we start seeing that play out when the dogs are placed and they're guessing or making attempts at how to resolve a new circumstance that they're exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this guessing happening, Wade, with Honor? Is he figuring you out day by day?
Every day, his mind's always working. Anytime that we are working, doing something, even if we're standing and I'm just talking to somebody, after a while, he'll start going through. He'll sit. He'll lay. He'll stand up. He'll turn around and sit. He'll heel. He's trying to figure out what exactly I want him to do because as I'm talking, I'm moving my hands and everything else, and he's like, oh, okay, what do you want? What do you want? And after a while, he'll get frustrated with me, and he'll grab his leash and tug it and be like, hello. You know, I've done everything I know how to do. What do you want from me?
Wade Baker is with us, a combat veteran from Nevada, Iowa, 41 years old, served in Iraq, also in Bosnia and Macedonia. Nicole Shoemate with us, executive director of Pause and Effect. That's a Des Moines-based non-for-profit organization which trains and places psychiatric service and mobility dogs. I wonder, Nicole, can you tell us, and I've read some about this, but I have to believe you are versed in this very well, how long back does our relationship with dogs go in human history? Do we know?
You know, it probably goes all the way back to, you know, the very first domesticated dogs. We're finding increasingly more scientific studies, less anecdotal information. A lot of references to mirror neurons, and they're finding that three species of animals have more concentrated mirror neurons than other species.
What are mirror neurons?
Mirror neurons are things that humans have. If you watch humans together, if you make contact or eye contact with another human, there's a certain amount of communication happening just in the eye contact, or how babies will mirror adults. If an adult moves a certain way or speaks with a certain inflection in their voice, The mirror neurons allow a child to reflect very well what they're witnessing in their environment. Dogs and horses also have a lot of mirror neurons. And so you're watching animals that are taking in their environment and reflecting what they see. So sometimes that's with expressions on their face. Sometimes that is following cues that maybe we're not aware of in the environment that they're relating to that we're not seeing. But I think, you know, probably the very first interactions, maybe what we were capitalizing on were those mirror neurons that scientific studies are now finding really do exist. And so when people say, my dog understands me, there's actually now scientific evidence that supports that, that mm-hmm. their dog probably really does understand them.
Mm-hmm. Wade, I wonder, you were also a previous dog relationship, a dog owner. You mentioned a type of bulldog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in old English.
Before Honor came along, were you aware of the complexity of the relationship between humans and dogs, your dog Honor and you?
Before the class and before being taught and then being shown, I didn't have any idea that it was as deep as it is. I kind of envisioned a service dog as a dog you say, go do this, and the dog wanders off and does it.
It's a biological robot for you.
Correct, and that's absolutely not the case. It is a relationship, a connection that we have that we're constantly working on.
In talking about dog-human relationships, can a human relationship with a dog be closer than a human-human relationship?
Should I announce that publicly to my husband?
go ahead.
Yeah, actually, I think a lot of times they are.
In what way?
I think they're less complicated. You know, I think that dogs don't quite put the same complicated demands on us. They don't share the same worries with us that maybe our spouses share. They're not interested in whether the house is picked up or the dishes are done or there's money in the bank accounts. I think it's just a much more pure love. I think it's easier to go out with the dog and play, and it's just not it's kind of just unfettered. Mm-hmm. It's really just a nice, pleasant relationship.
And dogs, as all animals have that quality of always being in the now, don't they?
They do. And that's really pleasant. It stops you from worrying too much about the past or too far into the future.
Mm-hmm. So they don't hold grudges.
I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, a dog can hold a grudge.
I have a couple dogs that occasionally hold a grudge.
How long will they remember a grudge?
A long time.
Wade Baker, what do you most appreciate about your relationship with Honor when we're talking about how they're different than human interactions and human relationships? Have you thought much about that, about why it's refreshing, why it's relaxing?
You know, Honor never asked me what's wrong, what's going on, what are you thinking, why are you doing that? He's just there. He's just purely there. He doesn't care why, you know, I'm agitated. He doesn't care why I'm yelling at the kids. He doesn't care why I'm, you know, upset about something stupid. He doesn't care. He's just, like you said, he lives in the now. He's there, and he's like, hey, something's not right. Let's fix it.
We talked about the evolution of the human-dog relationship, your reflections on that, Nicole. So I wonder what you think of when we project the dog-human relationship into the future. What could become of that relationship that we don't have yet?
You know, it's fascinating. Amongst dog trainers, I think we do spend a fair amount of time bantering about that topic. You know, sometimes you think you're just you're scratching the surface on what dogs are actually capable of performing. We have come so far from where we started as far as professional uses for dogs, using them as apprehension dogs or guide dogs. I think the last 20 years we've really seen the practical application of using dogs in healthy ways skyrocket. There are days you just hope that the, you know, possibilities are infinite.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nicole Shoemate and Wade Baker, it's been an insightful hour with you, an insightful time with you. And Wade, we wish you all the best with your new companion, Honor. Is Honor getting a little bit antsy to get out of the studio?
He's ready to go to work. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Nicole Shoemate is the executive director of Pause and Effect, a not-for-profit organization based in Des Moines that trains and places psychiatric service and mobility dogs. Wade Baker, is a 41-year-old combat veteran from Nevada, Iowa. River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available at iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear your comments about this or any other program. You can always contact us through our website, iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.